help those people, even the corporation people, find their way back to reality that, you know, we can't quench our thirst with money. We just can't do it. We can't make water with money. We can.
And that was Chief Kalene Sisk of the Winnemem Wintu Tribe in a talk that she called Water Knows Us. And you're listening to 90.1 FM KZFR People Powered Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Ron Topi, and this is your monthly North State Water Report. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner with the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Tires Plus. Complete auto repair and technicians at Tires Plus provide year-round services and maintenance for your vehicle, including scheduled maintenance, oil changes, AC and cooling systems, powder coating, and engine repair, along with Cooper, Michelin, and all types of AG tires. Located at 2624 Broadway Street, Tires Plus Complete Auto Repair can be reached at 530-342-8338. And at TiresPlusChico.com and on Facebook. And like I said, you're listening to your monthly North State Water Report. And I have a special guest in the studio tonight, and we're still waiting on another guest. So I'm going to play a song here. It's called Chinook Blues by Alice D. Maselli. And we'll get settled in for our interview.
You cramp my style. When you clear cut the forest, it's like pouring dirt into my home. When you clear cut that forest, it's like pouring dirt into the middle of my home. And when you muddy up my bedroom, I ain't got nowhere. Spawn.
when that urge takes hold of me.
And that was Alice DiMicelli with Chinook Blues. And the reason I played that song tonight is because we're going to be talking about wild Chinook salmon here in Butte County. As most of our listeners may have heard by now, there was a flume failure on PG&E's Butte Flume above Butte Creek in Magalia last month. The flume collapse was about 1,500 feet above Butte Creek, sending a torrent of millions of gallons of water down the hill, eroding and gouging out tons of heavy clay soil and rock into the creek. I'm sure many of you have seen photos of the creek turning into a dark orange mud. This not only affected the hydrology of the creek by damming sections, but it also affects the ecology of all the living organisms in the creek, including the only native spring run Chinook salmon left in California. Salmon face many challenges during their life on Butte Creek because of warm water temperatures, the loss of natural habitat, and mismanagement of the water diversion systems by PG&E and agricultural interests. The reason we spend time talking about salmon and salmon health on the North State Water Report is because salmon are a key indicator species of the overall health of our watersheds, our estuaries, our oceans, and so the overall health of water. Salmon are water purifiers. Salmon feed every aspect of life within the watershed during their life cycle. So when salmon are under constant threat, it means our water is under constant threat. So we're going to be talking about Butte Creek and this watershed tonight. And on tonight's show, I'll be talking with Hilo Ramirez of the Machupta Indian Tribe of Chico Rancheria, the original people of Butte Creek Canyon. Hilo is the tribe's director of the Office of Environmental Planning and Protection. I'll also have Alan Hawthorne in the studio, founder and director of Friends of Butte Creek, an organization dedicated to protecting Butte Creek and its native salmon run. So, Hilo, say hi to our listeners.
Het to Niam.
All right. Het to Niam. And that means?
Het to Niam is the conjugation for hello, y'all.
Oh, okay. We just learned a little bit of Machupta language. Hey, Tunaya. Anyways, I'm gonna start you off, and I need to turn my mic off for a second while I let Alan in the studio. So I wanted to start with you, anyways, tonight, and Maybe you could start by talking about the tribe's current relationship with Butte Creek and how important Butte Creek is traditionally to your tribe.
Yes, the Machupta Ma'a, Machupta people, are the indigenous peoples of Otakamsari, Big Chico Creek, Eskenemshawi, Butte Creek, and the Tsewotim Sacramento River in what is now Butte and Glen County, California. As the indigenous peoples of the Big Chico Creek watershed and the Butte Creek watershed, the river system is highly important to us. For centuries, it has sustained our people and also sustained wildlife for salmon and other species of high cultural importance that also have kept our people thriving for thousands of years. Not only that, but today our relationship with the creek is even that much closer since the tribe has acquired a nature preserve on Butte Creek, the Butte Creek Ecological Preserve, and is currently working on restoration projects on that land that the tribe now owns on Butte Creek to assist the salmon, increase wildfire resiliency, and reduce fuel loading.
So yeah, like, I need to turn my mic back on here. So yeah, like I mentioned at the start of the show here, PG&E has created another catastrophe up there with the flume collapse, and I was wondering if you know, if the tribe has in any way been, you know, your department been monitoring the situation on the creek and how that could affect the ecology of the creek with all of that. I mean, essentially, the creek looked like mud for a little over a week.
Yes. So as soon as it happened, our office had sent our land manager, Patrick, to go take some turbidity readings and other water quality parameters. And the it was around 350 NTU. And NTU is just the metric, but essentially if it's above 15, that's bad for salmon.
And how high was it?
350.
Oh, wow.
Yes. With the high levels of turbidity, there's also a relationship with dissolved oxygen. So dissolved oxygen tends to also decrease as turbidity increases. That's a compounding factor because the turbidity will clog up their gills, which they need to get oxygen. So if the water is already difficult to breathe in and then dissolved oxygen goes lower, it has a compounding effect. And with that high level of turbidity, the duration of that turbidity is critical in how it actually impacts them, because salmon can tolerate it for a wee bit. However, if it's sustained for weeks or many, many days, it can have very high deleterious effects. Thankfully, it looks like the turbidity dropped off after three or so days. There have been dead salmon spotted, but it looks like that also some salmon did survive and have been spotted.
Yeah, I'm wondering because, you know, I've been out to the creek. I haven't seen any dead ones, but I've been watching the turbidity as it's gone down. And what I have noticed, though, in like shallow riffles and along the edges where a lot of that sediment just kind of settled into the moss and everything on the rocks. So you still see these strips of orange. The water's not orange, but you can see all that sediment where it settled into the bottom of the creek and how that might affect spawning beds. Like all of that sediment that may be sitting where the salmon will go to spawn, how can that affect the eggs?
Yeah, we probably won't get a full picture of that until California Fish and Wildlife, DWR, and other agencies are done with their biological assessments and then get some figures on carcass counts and such. However, I do see it probably having a deleterious impact on their ability to spawn. Even the shock, the stress of that event might have impacts on that.
Right. I know, Alan, you... Let's make sure we got your mic hot here. I know you live or you have property in Helltown right above one of the main pools that they hold out in during the summer. Have you noticed? What have you been observing up on in that pool?
Well, we have seen zero salmon in our pool this year, which is probably the first time in 30 years haven't had any fish there. Apparently, what small run there is all moved farther upstream, and you know the conditions are much better upstream, so I don't blame them a bit. But it's, you know, we had a lot of water, and there was plenty of opportunity for them to be wherever they wanted to be. But like I said, not a single fish. Oddly, the day that this event happened, I was noticed about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I thought about it for maybe 5 minutes and jumped to my car and drove up the canyon, called a reporter on the way, got up to my observation deck at about 4 o'clock, and for the first time this year, I saw a salmon in front of the big boulder in our pool. And I just thought, how ironic that here I can see clearly into the water, I can see a fish, and within hours, this is going to be obliterated with silt and sediment. So
that was when the silt and sediment were on their way down?
Yeah. At 6 o'clock, the water was getting pretty cloudy, and by 7 o'clock, it was opaque.
And that was just a few hours after the flume burst. I mean, I took a hike up there. I went to Megalia, and we took a hike up on the flume. It was me and Zeke Lunder, and the PG&E guys were actually out there patching it at the time. They had a cement truck out there, and they were watching us like, what are you guys doing out here? You know, and they said, it's really unsafe. Be careful for the big hole over there as we were walking down the flume. And you know, we got some pictures, and we hiked down the hillside a little bit where the water, you know, there was a torrent just ripping the hillside apart. And we didn't get all the way down to the creek because it got pretty thick. But I know I did see pictures of what it looked like. Some folks did get down there at the bottom of the hillside where it washed into the creek. And man, what a mess.
Yeah, they estimate there's somewhere around 1,500 cubic yards of material on the bank down there. You can kind of picture a landslide up against the hill. It's 20 feet deep. Where it meets the creek, it's about 6 feet deep at the upper end, and then it tapers down like any other gravel bar normally would. But this is like a very abnormal gravel bar. It's full of sediment, full of other kinds of debris, and it's continuing to erode into the water, despite the fact the water is cleared up, you know, significantly down lower. This is still producing sediment. And we did have about a half an inch of rain on Sunday in the upper watershed, and that kicked up the flow and kicked up the sediment.
I was going to say, the first few heavy rains we had this fall are going to continue to wash the rest of that off the hillside and out of the creek beds, you know, the side of the creek bed.
When it starts stirring up the bottom, you know, everything that's sitting on the bottom right now is just going to be mobilized again, and down it'll come.
It's going to be a mess. I've got a question for you, Hilo. Has the tribe actually reached out to PG&E and try to work with them on maybe how they could better manage the infrastructure up there?
Yes. So that day I reached out to the PG&E tribal liaison, Reno Franklin, and we've been in talks with him, and he's been keeping us updated. And the tribe is now on a call with CDFW, DWR, and some other agencies on this incident management.
Good. I mean, how have you been out to the preserve yourself? Have you seen any effects out in the preserve of this?
Yeah. So the day of, you know, the whole river looked like chocolate milk. So I saw that, and there's still some sludge on the riverbanks and such. But other than that, it's too early to tell exactly, quantify that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I know. I mean, it's a big deal that I don't know how many of our listeners understand. Maybe you could talk about it a little bit, but Chico State granted the land of the Butte Creek Ecological Preserve to the Mechoopda tribe. And I'm not sure how many listeners actually know that. And maybe you could talk about that for a couple of minutes, just describe what happened and you know, what the tribe might be able to be doing out there now that you hold that preserve.
Yeah, I can talk a wee bit about that. So the Butte Creek Ecological Preserve historically was managed as a mining facility, and from the 1800s up until like 1950, 1960, were operating it as such. And essentially, they were just rerouting the creek to either side of the canyon in order to extract more gold. When they wanted more gold on this side, they'd reroute the creek to the other side and vice versa. After that, sometime in the late 1990s, early 2000s, around 2000-ish, it was put under a conservation easement through the Wildlife Conservation Board. And the Chico State Enterprises, it's technically not Chico State, it's an auxiliary nonprofit that is affiliated with Chico State University. They've been managing it for the past 20-odd some years. And just last year, Chico State Enterprises gave that land back to the tribe, and now the tribe is managing that Wildlife Conservation Board conservation land.
That's pretty big. Any restrictions out there? You know, is the tribe going to be able to go out there and practice some? I mean, what is the history of that area? Your history,
mm-hmm.
as far as, you know, go back further before the mining and before even contact. Were there village sites? Like, how important was Butte Creek to the tribe?
Yeah, there were several village sites. And I'm only the environmental director, so this question would be more appropriate for the tribal historic preservation officer of the tribe, Kyle. But there was one particular large village site just north upstream of the Butte Creek Ecological Preserve that's close by that was highly important to us. So that specific area, Butte Creek, is sacred land for the tribe. And there are numerous cultural resources other than salmon that are present that are important to tribal members, such as willow and California mugwort and other species that are used for food, fiber, and medicine. But going back to your earlier question about restrictions, because it has a conservation easement on it imposed by the State of California Wildlife Conservation Board, there's restrictions on what can and can't happen there. For example, no infrastructure can be placed there. And there are oddities like restrictions on taking material off the land. The conservation easement is very reflective of the worldview in Western spheres of what conservation means. So back in 2000, conservation meant kind of older definition of you just buy the land, you don't touch it, you leave it as is, and it'll take care of itself. But that erases thousands of years of intentional stewardship and management by Native American tribes. And if you leave a section and don't touch it, it comes into a state of disarray. Fuel loading happens, so you get a lot of higher densities of vegetation that are then more prone to having crown fires and having other aspects that are danger to human health, but also are not good for wildlife. TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, when it's used to manage land, not only does it increase usable material for cultural uses, but it also increases biodiversity. And there's a lot of research to show that under the intermediate disturbance hypothesis, that traditional stewardship is one of the best, if not the best metric we can use to steward the lands. But funny enough, an oddity, I kind of you said that to come back to my earlier point, is extraction of resources. When you think about people going and gold mining there, that makes perfect sense. You don't want people gold mining, disturbing the stream bed, and then extracting gold from this nature preserve. But when you think about tribal members and tribal folks in general wanting to go to the preserve and then gather willow and then take that willow home to then be made into baskets and such, that's not allowed underneath the conservation easement. Another part is using materials for profit. A lot of times tribal members will want to gather and then create baskets or create something or a tincture and then sell it or use it for barter, and that isn't allowed. So there's oddities in the easement.
So you don't really have sovereignty over that land.
No, it's not trust land. It's held in simple fee status. But okay. Yeah.
Well, maybe there's a possibility to whittle away at some of those barriers, so that you can start some cultural practices out there again. As far as any kind of salmon habitat restoration projects or anything, is there anything in the works that the tribe has?
Yeah, planning, yes. Implementation, as of right now, no. There is a lot of funding through NOAA and other federal agencies, and these federal and state funding resources oftentimes have tribal set-asides that only federally recognized tribes or federally and state recognized, depending on if it's the state or federal. The state of California is more friendly towards state or unfederally recognized tribes within the state versus the federal government. But there are lots of funding opportunities. It's a matter of getting good planning done and having shovel-ready projects that are ready for implementation. There is one project that was funded under a Bureau of Reclamation. Sorry, I'm always used to saying BIA, but Bureau of Reclamation, that Friends of Butte Creek got a year or so ago, and that is to fund some planning around Butte Creek on the Mechoopda-owned Butte Creek Preserve. And then there's also State of California CDFW-managed Butte Creek Preserve that is adjacent to the tribes one but goes downstream towards Durham, and it's to do some hydro mapping of those areas to help with future projects.
Wow. So I know there's a lot of work to be done out there. And Alan, maybe you can speak a little bit to, some of the challenges you've had over the years with Friends of Butte Creek, how many years you've been trying to, make the creek salmon friendly for all these years. And I know the Butte Sink is a big problem.
Yeah. I actually was super involved back in the late 90s working on Butte. I was working at Chico State, and I wrote a lot of grants, including the grants to acquire the reserve. And at that point in time, most of the restoration that was being done was repair and retrofitting of agricultural diversions out in the valley, which was more or less the bottleneck for the salmon at the time. Juveniles were getting, washed out into the rice fields, and adults were beating themselves to death trying to get up through clogged ladders. So there was something on the order of $25 to $30 million spent, mostly government people's money, and a lot of contribution from the agricultural folks down there, the diverters. And all four of the significant diversions in Butte County, that's the Parrott-Phelan, Durham Mutual, Adams Dam, and Goral Dam, all got new ladders and new fish screens. So for the first time in 100 years, fish had real clean passage up and down through that particular section. A couple of smaller diversions were taken out down below Nelson, and water was rerouted from other canals to supply those agricultural needs. And then down in the Butte Sink and Sutter Bypass, it's a maze of diversions and pumps, waterfowl clubs, refuges, you name it, it's all down there. And I kind of dipped my toe into that way back in the mid-90s and decided that was not something I could even begin to think of how to manage that. So I pretty much focused on, things up in the canyon. Really, there has been almost no restoration whatsoever of stream banks or, floodplain restoration. After the 97 flood, there was a lot of riprap put in a lot of places. We did go in and do a lot of planting in the riprap just to try and get some vegetation back onto the slopes. But when you're dealing with a 45-degree riprap slope, it's not the same as a natural bank. There's no erosion taking place, no gravel being introduced back into the creek. So it was kind of real disappointing that's what we ended up with after that big flood. But it was all emergency efforts that were done, and probably at least a mile worth of gunite and riprap were placed on Butte Creek after that flood. So what really kind of inspired me to get back into grant writing was the campfire and seeing what happened to the reserves as a result of the campfire. It really opened up the view and made it clear how disrupted the landscape was from the mining efforts.
How high up on the creek did they mine? I mean, they went way up into the canyon, right?
It's absolutely...
All the way? Pretty much all the way up?
There were dredges up in the Centerville area. Mm-hmm. Really, when you drive up there, all you have to do is look off to the sides of the road.
Yeah, you can see
You see pits and you see hills.
Right.
And most of the time, you see a pit with a hill next to it. So it's pretty obvious that there was some sort of dredging operation going there. There's one pond in particular that is just a little bit bigger than the size of a dredge. And our old historian that passed away a number of years ago, John Westland, told me the story of how this investor built a dredge. They drained this area, built the dredge on dry ground, and dammed it up, allowed the water to fill in, and it floated the dredge, and they began mining. And this was at a time when corporate laws were very strange, and this individual had taken in a whole bunch of investors' money from the Bay Area, put it in his pocket, and according to the law, he only had to operate the dredge for one day, and then all the money would be his, and he could continue operating it if he wanted to, but he didn't. And he took off with all the money and left this pond there. So this pond is, you know, nobody ever thinks of it as anything other than a duck pond or a goose pond.
Where is this? It's up in Centerville?
This is off Centerville Road. Huh. It's pretty obvious on the right-hand side, about halfway up between the bridges. So
I guess I never noticed that.
But actually, Zeke has, you know, helped me understand the LIDAR maps of all of Butte Creek. And you can see just perfectly clearly where a dredge was put in, and it went, you know, 200 yards up the bank, you know, all the way up into Centerville. The whole Butte Creek Island was completely mined. The whole Center Gap, or Castle Rock area, that was all huge piles back in the 60s, and they leveled it in the 70s and built a bunch of fancy homes. So that's kind of the way it's been up there. And interestingly, there's a soil scientist here in town with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and he showed me an air photo from 1952 of Little Butte Creek, starting down at the covered bridge and going about probably 5 miles up to where it splits off into Honey Run Creek, and Little Butte Creek heads on up to Bagalia. And there's a huge white line right up Little Butte Creek. You could not see the creek at all. Huh. And at the top of that line...
This is an aerial photo?
This was an air photo, black and white air photo. And at the top of that line was a dredge. And it was obvious. It was going up the stream.
It was a flume.
So it had gone from down by the covered bridge and just worked its way up Little Butte Creek and took out everything in, you know, a 100-foot wide swath all the way up to what's now the Horning Ranch, like I said, about 5 miles up the creek. So, you know, there was like nothing left, just rocks and no creek to see.
Wow.
So that's the kind of thing that they did wherever they could possibly do it.
Wow. You gotta wonder how much, you know, that kind of disturbance has affected, you know, the shallower aquifers in that area over all those, you know, after all those decades of doing that, and that water not being able to really connect with the shallow aquifers there, and all of a sudden the creek's kind of been left alone, yet it's still so highly disturbed. You have to wonder what it's done to the hydrology, the groundwater hydrology.
Well, in a fully functional floodplain, you're going to have a lot of different stages coming up from the thawweg of the creek. What we have now is it passes through these mining tailings. It's pretty much a channel.
Right.
And essentially what happens in that case is the water gets going faster and gets off the landscape faster. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping to be able to do the exact opposite, you know, give that creek bed some sinuosity so that the creek slows down and starts sinking in more and spreading out more, and doing exactly what you're saying, is recharging the groundwater.
Any talk about reintroducing beavers on Butte Creek?
I think that would be as California Fish and Wildlife a question. But that would be great to have beavers, but also just the scale at which the land historical land disturbance is, simply reintroducing natural flood architects such as beavers isn't going to be enough. There needs to be that intentional implementation of reconnecting the side channels and the floodplains, because like on the tribe's BSEP, Butte Creek Preserve, the floodplain is almost entirely disconnected from the creek. And you don't get that good recharge, but also it means that you don't have that biodiversity aspect. You have plants that grow right next to a river, and then you have upland plants. You don't really have that zone of introgression, which is harmful to just biodiversity overall. And then speak of the gravel pits. Not only are they not useful, but they're also harmful for salmon and other wildlife. If there are young salmonids and other aquatic organisms that are in the stream at a certain time, and then there's a flood event, and these empty ponds then fill up with water, but then there isn't a way of getting through there. It's just a lake. They can get trapped, and that entrapment is something that the Friends of Butte Creek grant that I mentioned does the hydro map, that'll do hydro mapping. We'll also be looking at with that mapping and such.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much once you, I mean, pretty much all the way from the river and through the Butte Sink and up into, you know, once you get on the upstream side of Skyway, there's just no riparian zone left. It's either houses or gravel, you know, mining tailing, piles of mining tailings. And I mean, you know, and then when you talk about the Butte Sink, that's a whole nother mess of, you know, what used to be just alluvial floodplain and habitat for probably not just salmon that came up Butte Creek, but so all the salmon that went up to higher creeks and the winter runs that went all the way up into the mountains on their way down would have used all of those, all of these alluvial plains like that, all these creeks like Butte Creek, you know, to hang out in for a while on their way back out, on their way out to the ocean when they're juveniles. And they just don't have that kind of habitat on the rivers anymore.
Butte Creek has really what I think is the most amazing flatland habitat of all the Central Valley creeks, or at least the Sacramento Valley. I can't say for sure of the Consumnes and all. I have a pretty good floodplain out in the valley, but Butte Creek's floodplain, you know, from Highway 99 literally down to the Sutter Bypass and on through the bypass is about 40 miles long, whereas Big Chico Creek comes out of the canyon and it hits the river, you know, in 5 or 6 miles. Mill Creek and Deer Creek are pretty much the same as well. So there's very little of that lowland floodplain rearing habitat that juveniles really like. So that's been one of the benefits to, you know, the populations on Butte Creek, is they have that extraordinary habitat down there. And even the Butte Sink, where a lot of these waterfowl clubs are, provides some pretty amazing habitat, as long as it's managed in such a way that the juveniles get out at the end of the duck season. And they've been working on this for a long, long time. There's a lot of progress that's been made down there, but there's still issues, and will continue to be issues. It's, you know, it's into the near future for sure. There's one more weir that needs to be fixed, and I think they're getting funding to fix that. So we'll see.
Yeah, I know. I was barely able to get a comment out of someone from that White Mallard Duck Club last year after, you know, a couple hundred fish died trying to get in, and I think his name was Chris Tocatlian that manages that land for the Duck Club and had posted some things on social media and, you know, kind of pointed the finger at, like, these aren't cleaned out enough and they couldn't touch anything until they got the okay. They needed permits and all this stuff. And I had him you know, I had him to be a guest on the show, and then he called me at the last minute and said that the president of the Duck Club will not allow me to go on and speak to any of this. So I don't know what they're trying to keep secret out there, but
well, there's touchy relations between the waterfowl clubs and the agricultural folks.
Oh, I'm sure.
From what I understand, the ultimate culprit in that particular incident were agricultural folks that were illegally diverting water. So I don't know that they were ever prosecuted or what, but they all have lots of lawyers and they love to sue each other. So I don't doubt that they wouldn't want Chris on the phone talking
right.
to you. So.
Right, right. I'm going to take a quick station ID break. You are listening to 90.1 FM KZFR Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And this is your monthly North State Water Report with Ron Topi. And I have in the studio, you've been listening to Hilo Ramirez of the Michupta Indian Tribe and Alan Hawthorne of Friends of Butte Creek. And we've been talking about Butte Creek and the challenges that salmon have and just the overall hydrological alteration that's happened on that creek and you know, the damage that's been done. And for the last few minutes of the show here, we're going to talk about what some possible solutions might be on that creek. But I'm going to read our underwriters here. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by DA Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and community radio in Northern California. For more information, visit dalampeconstruction.com. And by Mountain Sports, providing outdoor clothing and equipment for hiking, backpacking, camping, traveling, and enjoying the great outdoors. Mountain Sports is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at 176 3rd Street in downtown Chico, serving Chico and the North State since 1975. And I think what I want to move on to is a question. I know there was a town hall meeting a couple weeks ago, and it sounds like it was a really good one. A lot of people attended. I'll ask you for. I know you were there. Both of you were there. What was your takeaway from that meeting?
So I loved seeing so many local community members come in and support and just show up and make it known that they do want to see something done about this incident. I felt like it was helpful that we did have District Attorney Mike Ramsey make an appearance.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Wow. And he was able to share some information of how with the recent emergency spillway failure with the Orville Dam, that with that there was a very similar turbidity issue and such, and that there is a precedent of litigation by the cubic foot of debris that is put into a creek, and that is just the debris by itself. I know that the agencies are also concerned about impacts on salmon, but also other endangered species such as yellow-legged foothill frogs. So I think for me, I feel like that was nice knowing that the DA was looking into the matter.
Are they going to pursue?
That was not said, but
they're thinking about it.
There's thoughts.
Mike Ramsey has weekly meetings with PG&E. They're still dealing with the aftermath of the Dixie Fire, I'm sure. I think the campfire stuff is pretty well settled, but still, you know, they've been convicted of criminal violations, and Mike was instrumental in making that happen. So they like to stay in touch with him, and I'm sure they're having a lot of conversations about this particular issue. And, you know, it could be a significant fine, and, you know, we'll see if they pursue it in that direction. There are other options, and you wanted to talk about, you know, where we might go with all this. PG&E has been playing this little cat and mouse game with this project since the end of the relicensing period, which was in 2009, operating under an annual operating license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. and basically avoiding having to do any of the mitigations that were required as part of the relicensing, most significantly a temperature reduction device in the DeSalvo 4 Bay, which probably would have saved thousands of salmon 2 years ago.
Temperature reduction device?
A device to allow the water coming out of the two canals, the Butte Canal and the Hendricks Canal, to combine farther up in the reservoir and go directly into the penstock so that it wouldn't circulate around through the whole reservoir.
And get warmed up.
And in the summertime, it's a very shallow reservoir. It's pretty wide. And it heats up quite a bit. There can be as much as 2 degrees centigrade heating in that reservoir.
Oh, yeah, I've been up there, and it's like bathwater.
At the wrong time of year, that's deadly to the fish. So,
As we observed 2 years ago, thousands.
Mm-hmm. And you know, they, you know, nobody wanted to place the blame with PG&E for that, but the bottom line is that no matter what they do, even if they did put in a temperature control device, they're still right on the edge of survival for these fish. I mean, that they're not going to drop the temperature by 3 or 4 degrees. You know, they might be able to drop it by 2 degrees, but if climate change raises it 2 degrees, then it all goes away, and we're in the same boat. So
one of the questions I have about that, like with water temperature, and how I know most people, I don't know about the tribe. I know a lot of people though are in agreement that we really do need to keep the diversion from the west branch of the Feather River, because that's what keeps the water temperature cold enough in Butte Creek for the salmon. But how did salmon survive in that creek before any diversions like that?
Yeah, if I can talk to that. So currently infrastructure is being used to solve a problem caused by infrastructure. You dam the creek, so then you got to create a diversion from another river to then cool the water in that, because the salmon aren't able to get high enough in the watershed to get to the cool water. And we know that through climate change that the lower watershed that they are able to occupy right now near the Quartz Bowl and below the dams on Butte Creek, that habitat isn't going to be suitable in the next 100 years. With climate change, that habitat will not be suitable for them to spawn. And the only real remedy, like long term, is just remove those dams or find a way for them to get around the dams and then access the colder water higher up in the watershed so that essentially they could go up to Butte Meadows.
So traditionally they did go.
They went up the watershed.
Yeah, they went up the watershed. Well, that makes sense, yeah.
And you got to keep in mind that, you know, before the gold miners showed up, there were no roads in the watershed.
Right.
So when it rained, every drop soaked into the ground, and it came out in the springs and the streams. Mm-hmm. You know, as a much higher base flow than what we have today, because all of those roads accelerate runoff and allow that water to shoot out of the system before it soaks in. So the base flows were probably much greater before the gold miners started diverting water all over the place. And a lot of the barriers that have been identified in the upper section were actually caused by miners because they really like to go up and find a hillside, kind of similar to what happened with the PG&E canal failure, and they would just literally blast the hillside down into the creek, dam it up, and allow the tailings basically to come out the bottom, and they'd sluice out the gold. So there are numerous instances where, you know, there are whole big, you know, channel bars that were created by, you know, gold miners way back when. Wow. And even the Quartz Bowl itself has been blasted and appears to have had some sort of pipe coming from upstream and around over the waterfall and then on downstream to do some hydraulic mining downstream. So as Hila said, you know, we came in and made a mess of things, and now we're trying to do a whole bunch of other things to
mitigate.
To make it better.
I think it was Albert Einstein once said that you can't solve a problem with the same level of thinking that got you into it. And that's exactly what they're doing. And like you said, Alan, you know, before there were roads and everything, you know, every raindrop absorbed into the ground, and some of it formed little springs, and that water would perk through the ground and perk up into the creek and just keep the water temperature down and keep air, you know, keep it oxygenated and all that. And one other aspect of that was Hilo's ancestors were there, and they were mm-hmm. doing intentional burns to keep the land tended so right. that all of those things happen too. And, you know, maybe you can speak a little bit about that. Like you were talking about tech earlier and how it's been proven. There's data that shows that it's essentially the best way to tend the land here.
Yeah. So since you mentioned cultural burning, I'll talk about that on a small scale, but then you can imagine at a big scale. So some culturally important species, oak trees, and then geophytes. Colloquially, those are historically been named Indian potato and Indian onion. Mm-hmm. We live in the California Floristic Province. There's thousands of native species. It's one of the top 15 most biodiverse places on planet Earth. So there's a whole bunch of different plants that you can also humans can consume and eat. Through cultural burning of oak woodlands at specific times of year that coincide with when native plants like to germinate and start growing, but also with the acorn weevil life cycle. For the listeners, acorn weevils, you can just imagine a beetle. Imagine a beetle that infects acorns, and then it does it by drilling a hole through the acorn when it's growing during the summer. And then the larvae that are deposited, they eat the acorn from the inside out. If you're a people of acorns and salmon and all of your acorns are eaten by a beetle, that's not good. But if you burn at late fall, early winter, you're going to hit the weevils while there's still a larvae inside the acorn. You're also going to hit your geophytes and other native plants. Geophytes in particular, a lot of the species that are native to California, they either use fire as a signal to grow through the chemical signatures in the smoke or through the heat. And that's true for a lot of native species. So native species, they need to start their growth late fall. So you don't plant native plants in the spring, you plant them in fall. So by the timing of your burns and such, you're able to increase biodiversity, but also you're able to increase water. When vegetation becomes too thick within a spring or a hillside stream, through evapotranspiration, that dense vegetation releases all that water as water vapor into the atmosphere. And that dense, high density of vegetation, like we see in much of our forest today, which is due to mismanagement over the last 150 years, reduces water within the groundwater-dependent ecosystems. So if you burn and then thin the fuel loading and then also have higher, you have your fire mosaic, which creates your biodiversity mosaic, you're able to get more water in the stream, but also increase wildlife biodiversity.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know I've spoken to you a little bit about this in the past, Alan, how after the campfire, we had, what, two or three record runs of spring Chinook coming back up Butte Creek, which, you know, makes you question, you know, burning is, you know, burning revitalizes these watersheds. And I don't, maybe it was just a more natural cycle. I know salmon go on natural cycles, and how they'll you know, you have heavy years and then you have light years of return, and then, you know, a strong run comes back again for a few years and then comes back. But it seems like, you know, the fire may have helped, like, revitalize that water, as damaging as the campfire was. But at the same time, there's a lesson there in you know, intentional burning along Butte Creek could help salmon and salmon habitat and the water quality in general.
So the campfire actually happened after all the adults had died and left right. their eggs behind. There were only about 2,000 adults that year. And so it's not a big run by Butte Creek standards. And then immediately after the fire, we were concerned about toxic runoff, so we did a big project putting straw wattles out around burned out houses and shops and what have you. But then when the rains came, it was like ferocious rains that just washed black ash into the creek, and we just felt like there's no way these juvenile salmon that were, you know, just starting to emerge from the gravel, you know, really alevins with an egg sac still attached. Mm-hmm. We just thought there was no way they would survive. But to our surprise, 3 years later in 2021, we started seeing schools of 100 fish go by at a time. And
I mean, what was it, like 20,000 2 years ago?
At the end of the year, they ended up with a number of 21,700.
And a bunch of them died mm-hmm. because of the warm water.
And then 19,000 died because it got too hot, you know, right. And it's like...
Can't.
Once again,
yeah,
we're living right on the edge. The fish are trying as hard as they can, but
right.
we're just not giving them every opportunity we can. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Anyways, we have 3 minutes left, so I can give each of you maybe a minute or a little over a minute for a parting shot.
So, big picture here for Butte Creek, for us as a community to save the salmon, we're going to have to do something about create an access to the upper watershed. As we just talked about, 2 years ago, we had the largest salmon run in probably 20 or so years. However, even if you do have the largest salmon run of over 21,000 salmon, if their ability to live is dependent on other infrastructure and people utilizing that infrastructure then to channel water from a different river into this river to then get them to spawn, it seems like that's a very finicky situation to be on, is to rely on outdated infrastructure than to support other outdated infrastructure. But if we can get some kind of bypass or just dam removal or fish ladders so that they can get up there, we won't have to rely on these cascading events that need to happen that have a lot of potential for human error, which then can lead to 20,000 out of 21,000 dying.
And just to be clear about the water coming over from the West Branch, it travels through a tunnel under Sterling City and about 9 miles of canal, which is not in the best of condition either. And, for instance, had this canal failed, you know, the week before this heat spell we had in June of 2021 and all of that extra cold water went away, we would have lost all the fish for sure. So here again, we're living on the edge with this. One of the things that I've been scoping out, and I've learned a lot from Zeke about using Google Earth, and I've identified that from the Hendricks Head Dam, where the water is diverted out of the West Branch, directly over to the Butte Head Dam is about 4 miles. And with the technology for boring tunnels these days, that could probably be bored in about a week. There's some really high-speed boring machines that do that sort of thing. And that would be a way to take that water that's diverted out of the West Branch, deliver it much higher up into the watershed. And as Hilo said, we could take the dams out, put more water into the upper watershed, and get the fish all the way back up to Butte Meadows. And we would have, you know, a free river, wild and scenic forever.
Yeah, I think the next conversation we need to have is about water rights on Butte Creek and why, you know, what it would take. Because, I mean, that reservoir, there's water rights attached to that reservoir. So that's a whole nother can of worms, another hornet's nest outside of all of the diversions and everything that have happened over the years and the alterations of the creek. There's all these water rights, and that's a whole nother level of water policy in California that not enough of us are talking about and not a lot of people understand, and it'd be great to have a conversation about that sometime with either one of you or both of you in the future.
I'd love to come and talk about the 5 cubic feet per second that Friends of Butte Creek owns on Butte Creek. So,
all
for
right.
in-stream use only.
All right. Well, I'll hold you to that, Alan.
Thank you, Ron.
And we are out of time. Thank you, Hilo, so much for showing up tonight. And Alan, for coming in. Been a great show. And stay tuned next for Planetary Radio. Planetary Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by